a live presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here are your hosts, Katie Comley and Rita Farkas.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, BC introduces a new pay-at-the-pump gas law.
Vancouver Council turns down the plastic bag ban proposal.
And the Alberta government looks at injecting carbon dioxide into the ground.
We'll have all this plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour right here on News 101.
But first, with a look at some local news, here are News 101 reporters Carrie Baptist and Marie Bernard.
Remember UBC's plan to alert its entire cell phone toting student body via text message in case of an emergency? This Wednesday's security incident at the Biosciences building on Main Mall left many students wondering why they received no such text message to warn them of the still undisclosed security incident. UBC President Stephen Tope says that while the university had already purchased the technology allowing them to send out a mass text message to alert students in case of an emergency, it was decided that the machine would not be used because it had not yet been tested. Tope reasoned that more problems may have been caused by deploying the untested system, but that the system will be tested in the next few weeks. As of now, nearly 40% of UBC students have submitted their cell phone numbers so that they will be included in the program, but there are hopes that Wednesday's incident will motivate the other 60% to register.
And starting today, it's the law to pay for gas at the pump in BC Grant's Law, named after Grant DePatty, a gas station attendant killed while trying to prevent a gas theft, takes effect today. It requires that all drivers pay for gas at the pump 24 hours a day. Some gas station owners welcome the new law because they experience lost profits due to gas theft. Others complain that the new law will cost them money to pay for protections for night workers like barricades and locks. For many drivers, the new law will not have much of an effect as many already pay at the pump with their credit or debit card. For those who use cash, however, the new law may be a bit of an inconvenience.
Proposed social housing in the downtown east side is one step closer to reality. The city chose 12 nonprofit organizations to manage 1,200 new housing units around the city. Minister of Housing Rich Coleman said that the nonprofit organizations were chosen for their experience and expertise in managing social housing. The next step is for each group to hold a public consultation process, which will hopefully begin in June. After that, six of the housing projects should be ready to break ground by the end of the year. Last year, the city bought 12 sites around the city where they plan to build subsidized and supported housing.
And BC Place may get a facelift in time for the 2010 Olympics. The Vancouver City Council has approved a fast-track proposal under which the BC Pavilion Corporation will be able to sell off land near BC Place to developers and use the proceeds of the sale to renovate the stadium. Possible improvements include replacing the stadium's Teflon roof, which collapsed last winter. The vacant land to be sold will be zoned for residential towers and commercial development. BC Place is booked 200 days a year and generates an economic impact of $58 million. And plastic bags are in for now. Vision Vancouver proposed a ban on plastic bags in Vancouver, but was shot down by the NPA, Mayor Sam Sullivan's group in the City Council. This comes despite Sullivan's past promises to make Vancouver a leader in environmental sustainability. Vision Vancouver Councillor Tim Stevenson claims that after 2 years in charge, the NPA has taken little real action towards environmental sustainability, preferring instead empty rhetoric and greenwashing of normal programs. Vancouver's introduced a motion in November to have a report created to debate how to phase out plastic bags from Vancouver. At last night's meeting, Vision Vancouver proposed that staff identify specific options for implementing the plastic bag phase out, and the NPA refused to support the motion, so it failed. And in UBC News, we'll now take a look at some related events with Radio Free UBC.
Today on Radio Free UBC, Vanock visits UBC. And the BioSci lockdown. The famous University Board of Governors has met yet again. Thursday, they met for committee meetings in the Ponderosa Cafe at UBC. Students will note that this time the famous University Boulevard development project and its famous $40 million bus loop did not make it onto the agenda. This is the second important time that the bus loop plan failed to make it onto the agenda. Students suspect that the reason for this is because the province has plans to bring out the TransLink line along the Broadway corridor to the university within the decade. The $40 million bus loop has been widely recognized as being an obstacle to further developments of the TransLink line, and furthermore is very unpopular on campus. The $40 million bus loop takes $30 million from the childcare fund on campus and reroutes that $30 million into the bus loop to create a 1,300 spaces shortage in childcare. Keep posted to find out more about the University Boulevard development plan and the university's $40 million bus loop with $30 million from the Child Care Fund. In addition, the university is so stupid that in their recent development plans and their recent consultations, they've done such a bad job that word has just come in that through campus and community planning, the university has directed Nancy Knight, the developer of the plan, to hand space over, the University Boulevard area, over to students. This is called Plan C and is a new development and is the product of the university's absolute incompetence in planning the space. But keep posted on student control over student space on campus and over the university's expenditure of $30 million from the Child Care Fund on the $40 million bus loop.
This morning, the Vancouver Organizing Committee for the 2010 Olympic and Paralympic Games, or VANOC, made a special appearance on campus. VANOC, along with UBC President Stephen Toop, hosted an event this morning at the Chan Center. The event was intended to be an information session to let students and faculty know about the 25,000 volunteer positions needed to be filled for the upcoming games. The official call for volunteers will take place on February 12th. VANOC has been increasingly criticized for their promotion of legislation that infringes upon basic civil liberties, such as Sam Sullivan's Project Civil City, which targets homeless persons and dumpsters in alleyways as causes of public disorder. The project relies heavily on the idea of public order and places emphasis on having an increased policing and security measures just in time for the Olympics. Now consider this in light of Wednesday's SWAT team extravaganza at the Biosciences Building on the UBC Vancouver campus. A lot of people are talking about Wednesday's lockdown of the Biosciences Building on campus. Rumors are circulating that there was an email bomb threat, which doesn't really make that much sense considering that students were locked down inside the building, or that there was an armed gunman running around in the Biosciences Building, which may be closer to the truth considering that the RCMP, a SWAT team, and a police helicopter, all institutions that carry guns, were present. So in light of the fact that no persons with information as to why the building was locked down, Radio Free UBC is piecing the bits together. Our CMP spokesman, Inspector Dave Walsh, has stated that the content of the threat is specific and contains a deadline, although he would not elaborate on the nature of the threat or how it was made. Walsh also said that police believe the threat has been mitigated, even though no arrests have been made. He added that the police presence will be higher than usual on campus for the next few days. Now, considering the timing of Wednesday's Bioscience building incident, in combination with the fact that no one's answering questions about why an entire building was locked down with hundreds of students inside of it, and that VANOC made a special appearance on campus, it doesn't seem so far-fetched to look into how the upcoming Olympics are negatively affecting people and their civil rights. I mean, hey, if cops are able to invade a biosciences building at an educational institution for no apparent reason, what kind of precedent does that set for a supposed high-security event such as the Olympics?
The BioSci lockdown also raises some interesting questions about security culture in general. The BioSci lockdown didn't come out of nowhere, and some of the reasons for these security measures are actually reasonable, or seem so. After some gun incidents in the United States, the UBC administration prepared some emergency response plans. The emergency response plans, or ERP, were written up by the Environment and Disaster Response Team at UBC, led by David Zlachik. And he did that in consultation with the RCMP campus security. And the plans that were carried out on Wednesday were plans that were drawn up in case of, you know, a gun incident on campus. So it's not that these things come out of nowhere, but it's interesting to see how normalized RCMP power and security culture is being is these days in the context of the Olympics. So although the justification for such overwhelming force comes out of safety and security, thoughts about safety and security, it's just interesting to see how that can then be used to normalize a really overwhelming response. And it's also interesting to note that on the Command Center committee that consists of UBC administrators, it is chaired by Scott McCrae, who is the head of communications at UBC. And he has obviously done a poor job in communicating the reasons for this crackdown. Apparently, there was an email sent out of the sub, the student union building at UBC, about a threat, but the computer has been seized from the AMS, but it has not been made clear whether the threat was valid, whether the RCMP overreacted. They haven't made clear since the time what has happened, so rumors are still circulating. And all of this really, really begs the question of whether the RCMP is going to be transparent. And if they're going to be using overwhelming force, they have to be very transparent in why they're using it and if it's really legitimate and is really has to do with safety or if it really is a drill that is just under disguise.
And thanks, as always, to Radio Free UBC for that piece. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
If you're interested in a wicked mix of performances all taking place in one night and locally at one place, then...
It's the fourth annual fundraiser for the North Shore Women's Center.
We're talking about an all-women's mixed program, a rare artistic collaboration of acclaimed local performers that have come together for a common cause.
Happening Saturday, February 2nd, 2008 at the Centennial Theatre located at 2300 Lonsdale Avenue in North Vancouver.
Tickets available after January 24th, either in person or by phone at the North Shore Women's Center, the Centennial Theatre box office, or Little Sisters. Reach us by phone at 604-984-6009.
Performances include dancing, theatre, improv, and more. Early bird tickets available.
We're here to inform you about African Awareness Week happening at UBC between the dates of February 1st and February 8th.
This is a unique event with the purpose of increasing awareness about the importance of Africa studies at UBC. We will accomplish this by holding seminars, workshops, and events during that week and presenting world-class African scholars, writers, artists, and activists to carry our mission of exceeding the layperson's expectations of how much Africa has to give to the world.
All are welcomed. For more information or for details on the seminars, workshops, and events, please visit the website at www.africa-awareness.ubc.ca. If you want to know the truth and drop a stereotypical perception of Africa, this is your chance to become an informed citizen. www.africa-awareness.ubc.ca.
To dance, Papa. Oh, can't we see the pretty horses?
Yes, on February 8th.
Oh, but do tell me where, Papa.
CITR's party celebration, being held at the sub at UBC, 7 p.m. in the evening.
May we dress up?
Oh, but of course. You may dress up as your favorite dead trend. It's the theme.
Oh, will there be a small prize for the best costumes?
Yes, there will, little one.
19 plus.
Refreshments available.
Room 216.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:21. Now with a look at other BC news, we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Tracy Fuller and Carrie Baptist.
The provincial government plans to distribute welfare payments on direct debit cards to 20,000 recipients who don't have bank accounts. Every month, Victoria will put welfare payments onto the debit cards, which can then be used at any ATM or commercial outlet. Proponents of the plan include Employment Minister Claude Richmond, who says areas such as Vancouver's downtown east side direct deposit works well. Vancouver's downtown east side work well because the program takes large amounts of cash off the street on check issue day. Critics of the plan have complained that this program might compromise recipients' privacy because the government could track people's expenditures. However, the BC government claims they have no plans to monitor the welfare clients' spending habits.
In order to protect students from fraudulent college operators, the BC government will issue a seal of approval to post-secondary institutions that provide a quality education. This program is designed to repair the reputation of BC's colleges, which has recently been crippled by scandal. In the past few years, several private post-secondary schools were forced to close after they were discovered to be issuing degrees which they were not accredited to grant. These scams shook public confidence in BC's post-secondary sector. The governments of China, India, and Korea warned students to steer clear of private colleges in BC. The provincial government is hoping its new seal of approval will help restore foreign confidence in BC's post-secondary institutions and mean an increased number of international students coming to the province for an education.
There are big changes brewing for the Evergreen Line. Instead of being a light raid line, the new proposal for the Evergreen Line is to be similar to the SkyTrain system or Canada Line. This will cost more to build, about $20 million more. But officials say this amount will be made up later as labor savings, as cars won't need drivers. The proposed northwest route will probably be used rather than the southern one, because of problems caused by tunnels and steep hills. This new proposal will have a 45-day consultation period, and then area mayors will vote on it. TransLink says the advantage of a SkyTrain system over light rail is increased speed and a 2.5 times greater carrying capacity.
The introduction of a new taxi bill of rights for passengers has received mixed reviews from passengers and cab drivers alike. However, Muslim drivers are now worried that their inability to refuse passengers with animals, such as people who require the use of guide dogs, will go against their religion. The religious beliefs of many Muslims prevent them from coming into contact with animals, including dogs. And with the implementation of a new 288 fare refusal fine, some drivers argue that instead of being forced to accommodate passengers with guide dogs against their religious beliefs, they should have the right to tell the passenger to find another cab. Vice Chair of the Canadian Muslim Federation, Aziz Khaki, is calling the issue a clear case of discrimination and insensitivity on behalf of the authorities. President of the BC Civil Liberties Association, Jason Grattle, has agreed with Khaki that the Ministry of Transportation should look into the oversight. We're going to take another break now, but when we come back, we'll update you on national and international news. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
The Spartacus Youth Club Class Series presents The Fight for Revolutionary Marxism, a series of readings and films presented throughout the fall semester at UBC. The next presentation is
February 6th, Wednesday, 6 p.m., Room 212, The Deception of Bourgeois Democracy. Break with pro-imperialist NDP for a revolutionary, multiracial workers' party fighting for socialist revolution.
Readings include Imperialism and the Split in Socialism, V.I. Lenin, Lenin and the Vanguard Party, a Spartacus pamphlet, pages 11 to 16 and 47 to 55, for class struggle against capitalist reaction, NDP in bed with bosses' parties, Spartacus Canada, number 148, and the IG in executive office, sewer centrism, Workers' Vanguard, number 895.
All classes held in the Student Union Building, UBC. For information and to obtain the readings, contact the SYC at 604-687-0353. Email trotskyist_vancouver@shawcable.com.
20th. Tune in all night long for the Homelessness Marathon on CITR.
Why do a nationwide homelessness marathon?
Because homeless people should have access to the media where they can freely speak out. Because it is the homeless who are best able to educate people on the issue of homelessness.
This 14-hour broadcast will begin at sunset on Wednesday, February 20th, and continue through sunrise the next day in front of the Native Friendship Center of Montreal.
This year, more than 30 stations are carrying the Homelessness Marathon. For more info, visit www.citr.ca.
To participate, dial 1-866-763-4136. Call toll-free.
Did you say you don't want people giving you too much?
No, well, you don't want to see, like, when you panhandle, people like you to come up with some clever kind of saying. And it's really unique, because every individual's got what's going to make them laugh, and you may not even understand why they're laughing.
And the news continues on CITR. The Alberta and Canadian governments have introduced a new initiative aimed at reducing greenhouse gases. Yesterday, the two governments announced a $2 billion carbon capture and storage plan, which, if implemented, will store harmful carbon dioxide emissions in the ground. When the CO2 is released from oil and gas operations, coal-fired power plants, and industrial sites, the new storage plan would capture the emissions and inject it deep into the earth, rather than allowing it to escape into the atmosphere. The new plan follows a report that recommended the storage method, but many critics are already concerned. John Bennett of climateforchange.ca says taxpayers should not have to pay for the mitigation efforts of polluting industries. He said it is unacceptable for industries to both pollute and ask for assistance in cleaning up pollution. Bennett, like others, says regulations that force the industry to reduce emissions is a better way to curb climate change. With more on national news, here once again are Tracy Fuller and Marie Bernard.
Canada's Chief of Defense says Canadian soldiers will remain in a combat mission if they stay in southern Afghanistan. General Rick Hillier says it's impossible for troops to remain in the area on a strictly humanitarian or development mission. This in response to the Liberal Party calling for an end to the Canadian combat mission by February 2009. Hillier says the region is too volatile to expect that troops could avoid engaging in a combat mission. Since the return to Parliament this week, the issue of Canada's mission in Afghanistan has been hotly debated, with Prime Minister Stephen Harper proposing that troops stay on. Harper says Canada will commit to extend the mission past the expected pullout date in February if NATO countries provide more troops and more equipment. Harper's conditions follow those suggestions made by John Manley in a recent report to the government. General Hillier says Afghan forces are not yet strong enough to defeat counterinsurgency operations. He adds that he will accept whatever decision the Canadian government makes on the future of the mission, so long as it honors and the sacrifices already made by our troops.
And the American Federal Drug Administration is warning that certain drugs used to treat epileptic seizures can dramatically increase the risk of suicide. The FDA began a large-scale investigation into epilepsy medications in 2005. Some of the drugs tested have been available for decades. The review found that drug-treated patients faced about twice the risk of experiencing suicidal thoughts or behavior. Anti-seizure drugs are prescribed for many illnesses not related to epilepsy, including migraine headaches, some nerve pain disorders, and psychiatric conditions like bipolar disorder. The FDA only tested 11 anti-seizure medications, but they say they expect that all medications in the anti-epileptic class probably increase the risk of suicide. They're asking manufacturers to add product warning labels and want doctors to discuss the risk of suicide with their patients. Here at home, Health Canada says it's aware of the FDA's findings and will give new information to the public and Canadian healthcare professionals as soon as it's available. The agency is working on a class labeling system that will ensure all anti-epileptic meds carry the same warning. Health Canada warns that patients who are already taking anti-epileptic medications shouldn't make any changes without talking to their doctors first.
In international news, talks to end the post-election violence in Kenya are progressing. Free Speech Radio News has more on this.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon joined his predecessor Kofi Annan in Nairobi today to boost Kenyan mediation talks. The talks follow more than a month of civil violence in Kenya, resulting from claims the national elections were rigged. More than 800 have died, and thousands have been displaced from their homes. Against the backdrop of two recently murdered opposition leaders, the talks have made promising progress over the past 2 days. In fact, a new 18-point plan to help end the violence has reportedly been reached. FSRN's John Bukali reports from Nairobi.
Late today, Kofi Annan issued a statement that the government and opposition had agreed on a 4-point framework for talks which should end the violence within the next 2 weeks. The items on the agenda include tackling the humanitarian situation, resolving the political crisis, plus dealing with the land and historical injustices. Mr. Annan announced that he expected the violence, humanitarian crisis, and political crisis to be tackled within 2 weeks. Yesterday, the talks had to be adjourned prematurely when David Kimutai Toh, the second Orange Democratic Movement legislator, was shot dead. Both men were killed within a period of 36 hours. The ODM has accused the government of being behind the two murders. Opposition leader Raila Odinga is calling for independent investigations.
We therefore urge that assistance of an independent organization be sought to actually get to the root cause of these two deaths. Here we have already now an offer from FBI. I challenge them to state today clearly that they will accept the services of this independent organization.
The opposition claims that the government is keen on reducing their majority in parliament. But even as the opposition and government trade accusations, there's an attempt to reach a peaceful solution through mediation talks. Kofi Annan, former UN Secretary General and chair of the talks, said that the mediation is geared towards realizing both short and long-term solutions. In the short term, the goal is to end the one-month-old violence and to address the disputed presidential election results. The UN Secretary General, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, arrived in the country today and held a meeting with the mediation team. He also met privately with Raila Odinga. But even as the French Foreign Affairs Minister, Mr. Bernard Kouchner, called for the UN Security Council to step in and help end the violence, the Secretary General focused on humanitarian efforts.
I'm here to urge and appeal to people and government to resolve all the issues in a peaceful manner. And I'm here also to assure the humanitarian assistance.
I am deeply concerned about this situation, and the number of deaths is just intolerable and unacceptable in modern world. This must stop.
Look beyond this individual interest, look beyond the party lines, look toward the future, a brighter future of your country.
The UN Secretary General did not say what action, if any, the UN plans to take towards solving the political crisis in Kenya and ending the violence. For now, the immediate future of Kenya still appears bleak. Revenge attacks in central Kenya, a predominantly Kikuyu community area, are on the rise. These retaliatory attacks only serve to exacerbate the ethnicity that flared the earlier attacks against the Kikuyu. In light of the extreme ethnic dimension of the conflict in Kenya, the United Nations Special Advisor for the Prevention of Genocide, Mr. Francis Deng, is calling for a more concerted response from the global community.
But what we need to do really is for the voices of the world to come together to tell the leaders of Kenya that they must rise above the factionalism and above the identity conflicts of their ethnic groups to restore order to the country in the interest not just of Kenya but of the region, because Kenya is central and what happens in Kenya affects the whole region.
What will happen next in Kenya is now likely dependent on the outcome of the mediation talks. The next 2 weeks of intense mediation, as per the 4-point agenda that Kofi Annan announced, may very well determine whether peace will prevail in Kenya or not. For Free Speech Radio News, I am John Bwakali reporting from Nairobi.
And thanks as always to Free Speech Radio News for making that piece available for us to rebroadcast to you. Our producer Megan Turcotto is here now with a look at the oddity of the week. Megan, what have you got for us?
Today, German nudists will now be able to travel to their destinations in the buff, thanks to an Eastern European travel firm which will start running trial flights from the Eastern German town of Erfurt to nudist resorts on the Baltic Sea. The cost of a round-trip flight in the nude is steep, 499 euros or $735 US. But managing director Enrico Hess says it's only because the plane is very small and the program has just started. There's no real reason why a flight on which one flies naked should be more expensive than any other flight. Passengers will be required to remain clothed until they board the plane and put their clothes back on prior to disembarking the flight. The crew, however, will remain clothed throughout the duration of the trip for safety reasons. Hess says that it was a customer suggestion that prompted them to start the program. And he doesn't want people to get the wrong idea. He is not starting a swingers club in midair or something like that. They are a perfectly normal holiday company.
Wow.
I'm just picturing, like, the captain, you know, being like, and your seatbelt sign has been turned off, and you may now remove all your clothes. Everyone being like, woo, clothes flying everywhere throughout the cabin.
Well, I want to say that I think it's fabulous because I personally hate sitting on a plane for, let's say, 8 hours and feeling like you've been wearing the same clothes for 2 days, which you usually have been. Mm-hmm. Because if you're traveling internationally, you have a 6-hour layover, you leave the place you were at, like, early that morning, you get home some night and you're like, wow, I've been wearing this underwear for... feels like 2 days, and I'm sweating, and I'm hot, and I'm cold.
So Rita just wants to be able to change in the middle of the flight. That's
well, but you can't shower, so maybe you should just do it in the buff.
Although, I don't know, airplanes are pretty dirty. Thinking how many people fly on an airplane, how many times it's reused, and how well do they clean that airplane? I don't know what you'd... Especially if people are naked, like...
Yeah, you don't want to be sitting on those chairs. I don't think...
I wouldn't want blankets either, or pillows.
What about some sort of, like, plastic, like, number?
Like the couches that your parents had covered with plastic? Maybe. It'd be...
They just spray them down at the end of all the flights?
Right. Like... I don't know how comfortable that would be.
Yeah.
But I think it's a great initiative. I really do. I think it'll change the dynamic of flying completely, and the Mile High Club will grow.
Do you think the flight attendants would also be naked?
No. For safety reasons, they will not be naked. I don't know if this is just spilling coffee on yourself or if there's other safety problems that come from not wearing clothes.
Well, you know, it's interesting there in Europe. They have some interesting ways of doing things because I know I read an article about Czechoslovakia having weather women doing it in the nude.
Yeah, naked nude.
To appeal to, you know, for people to listen more often. So there we go.
That's very interesting oddity, Megan. Thank you. And obviously, naked flights serve a niche. So there you go.
Thanks, Megan.
All right, it's time to move on to the arts report with our very own arts director, Katie Fitzpatrick.
Hello and welcome to your 5-Minute Arts Beat here on News 101. I'm your host, Katie Fitzpatrick. Now, coming up in our 5-Minute Break here today, we're going to have a review of the production The Fever, currently on at the Beaumont Studios, which I had the chance to check out on Wednesday night. Except for right now, we're going to get to a few listings. First up, there's The Black Rider, the casting of The Magic Bullets. It's a part of the Push Festival. It's presented by November Theatre and the Arts Club Theatre Company. It's an expressionist musical created by Tom Waits, William S. Burroughs, and Robert Wilson. It's still February 9th at the Granville Island Stage. I had the chance to check it out a couple weeks ago, and it's a great production. Another one currently on is Banana Boys. Leon Orius' play, based on Terry Wu's novel, about five regular Asian-Canadian guys in their mid-20s, struggling with issues of identity and self-worth. That's still February 9th at the Fire Hall Arts Center on East Cordova. The Blonde, the Brunette, and the Vengeful Redhead. Lucy Peacock portrays seven different characters in a one-woman production about the shattered life of a suburban housewife. That is at the Vancouver Playhouse till February 2nd. Another production as part of the Push Festival is My Dad, My Dog. It's a comedy about a woman who is convinced that her dead father has been reincarnated as a dog. That's till February 2nd, which is tomorrow night, at the Roundhouse Community Arts and Recreation Center. So you only have two more nights to go check that one out. Finally, one that's part of the Push Festival as well is Clark and I Somewhere in Connecticut. Rubble Productions and Theatre Replacement present a drama based on photo albums and travel journals actor-writer James Long found in an alley. That's also till February 2nd at 9 p.m. at Performance Works on Cartwright. Studio 58 presents Sandy Wilson's musical romance, The Boyfriend, set at a fashionable finishing school on the French Riviera in the 1920s. That's at Langara College, Studio 58, till February 24th. Finally, one more thing going on in theater is The Dark Between. Craning Neck Theater presents a new play by Jeremy Waller based on the life and work of Canadian poet Pat Lowther. That's at the Beaumont Studios till February 16th. In dance, there's In Bulk, In the Belly. The Dance Center presents a collaboration between choreographer Carolyn Debbie and filmmaker Clancy Dennehy, exploring the human journey from death to new life. You can find more information at thedancecenter.ca, and you can actually hear an interview with Carolyn Debbie on Tuesday's Arts Express at 2 o'clock here on CITR 101.9. Also going on in music right now, there's the Spirit of Haida Gwaii concert. The Vancouver 2010 Cultural Olympiad, Christchurch Cathedral Guild for the Arts, and the Bill Reid Foundation present a concert featuring performances by Gu Jay and Terry Lynn Williams, plus Bruce Riddle's Spirit of Haida Gwaii. That's tonight at 8 p.m. and February 2nd at 3 p.m. at the Christchurch Cathedral on Burrard. Another event going on in music is From Czech with Strings. Under the baton of John Van Dersen, Orchestra Armonia, featuring cellist Jan Haliska, performs music by Handel, Boccherini, Janáček, and Kinnens. You can find more information at orchestraharmonia.com. That's February 2nd at St. Philip's Anglican Church. A couple events going on in literary events right now. One is Story Feast 2008. And if you were listening to Last Arts Express, you would have heard an interview with the artistic director of that festival. It's the 16th annual Vancouver International Storytelling Festival, which features tellers from the Latin American community, concerts, a cabaret, workshops, and kids events. That's on from February 1st tonight until the 3rd. Lots of events going on over the weekend for that. It's at the Heritage Hall on Main. Finally, one more event in literary events. Anne-Marie Fleming, The Magical Life of Long Tack Sam. Launch of Fleming's graphic novel, The Magical Life of Long Tack Sam, plus a screening of her 2003 film of the same name. That's February 2nd from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Emily Carr Institute on Johnson on Granville Island. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I was going to do a review of The Fever, which I had the chance to check out at the Beaumont Studios on Wednesday night. It's a production being put on by 20-something Theatre, and it represents their yearly spotlight on an outstanding performer. This year, the spotlight was on Kirsten Kilburn, who took the stage all by herself to perform a lengthy monologue as the narrator. The show was originally written by Wallace Shawn, a man best known for saying inconceivable in The Princess Bride. However, Shawn was a playwright and theater actor whose extreme left-wing, nearly communist politics often boiled over into his stage work. This is certainly the case with The Fever. I actually heard one woman walk up to the director afterwards and say, "I just hate this script. It's a bunch of left-wing rhetoric. But I think you did a very good job. You gave it all the meaning you possibly could have." The director, Sabrina Everett, seemed a little taken aback, and so was I. True, Shawn's play carries strong political implications, but they are presented so convincingly, with so much powerful psychological imagery, that I don't think the play can be dismissed as mere rhetoric. The play follows Kirsten's character, the narrator, as she struggles to reconcile her wealthy past with the poverty she sees around her when visiting a poor country that is undergoing a communist rebellion. Slowly, she realizes that she is not rich because she fundamentally deserves to be, at least not more so than the peasants and farmers she is encountering. She tries to justify keeping her own money, but can find no real justification. She sees herself as a good, decent person who loves life and the arts, is kind and lighthearted. And how can she truly be good and decent if she turns her back on the suffering and goes to an opera instead? She gives the beggar a little something, but wonders why she shouldn't just give it all. Although she doesn't find an excuse not to, she keeps it anyway. Presumably, Wallace Shawn is still keeping his too. We all feel we should share our wealth too, but we won't. At least not to an extent that would actually inconvenience us. The strength of this script is that it empathizes with the feelings many of us face in the modern world. How to go about our lives without being torn apart by grief and guilt. The radical aspect is that it says we should not just go on with our lives, but should respond to the guilt, soak in it, stew in it, and make a change. We in fact stew in guilt throughout this play, as images of gore and injustice are thrown at us constantly. It's a heavy piece to digest, but Kilburn pulls it off incredibly, giving it weight without making it melodramatic. Slipping seamlessly from her childhood headspace of entitlement to her new revelations about the injustice of the world, she taps into all of our appreciation of the beautiful and the good and our desire to celebrate and love life, rather than to rebel against its hardships and ugliness. Ultimate, though, she forces us to see that the rebellion is necessary. Of course, we all cared for a couple hours and then went back to our justifications. I certainly would not say that this play has convinced me of Wallace Shawn's politics. It has, however, forced me to look more carefully into my own thinking, something that any great piece of art should do. The Fever is showing at the Beaumont Studios at 315 West 5th until February 3rd. Once again, for your 5-Minute Arts Report, I'm Katie Fitzpatrick.
And thanks for that, Katie. Before we go tonight, we're going to check in with a look at your weekend weather, and our meteorologist Selena Ferris is not in this afternoon, so here instead is Marie Bernard with our fully clothed weekend weather forecast. Marie?
Thank you very much. Tonight, it's currently 6 degrees in Vancouver, and there is a 60% chance of rain or flurries with a low of 1 degree. Tomorrow, the high is 5 degrees. There are a few flurries or rain showers expected in the morning,
And then cloudy with sunny periods and a 60% chance of rain or up to 2 centimeters of snow. A low of 1 degree with a 30% chance of rain or flurries. And on Sunday, the high is 4 degrees, a mix of sun and cloud with a 30% chance of rain or snow with a low of 1 degree. And temperatures should be rising on Monday and Tuesday.
That's our program for February 1st, 2008. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts, and if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca.
Megan Turcotto produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Katie Comley.
And I'm Rita Farkas. Thanks for listening. Coming up next, CITR Sports Friday, women's basketball action live from War Memorial Gym. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.